Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, welcome back to Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. This is a new series, Missed You Like Crazy. Great to be back. And we're kicking off with tattoos, the art of painting on the skin. Fashionable now, isn't it? But it wasn't always so. In fact, my mum was very sniffy about people who had tattoos, even her dad, who was a sailor and had got one. But I'm fascinated by the fact that tattoos are like a little piece of art that you just wear with you all your life, sometimes in very private places. So where do they all come from? The idea of them, what's the history behind them? Where can we find the oldest tattoo? And when did tattoos stop being taboo? I'm discussing all this and much more with my two very special guests, the tattoo and tattooed historian Matt Lodder, and the indelibly inked and superbly talented tattoo artist and presenter, Grace Neutral.
So the oldest tattoos that we have actually in skin are on a European guy, an early Bronze Age, Copper Age guy called Otzi.
This is the Frozen Man.
Yeah, literally the Frozen Man. He was murdered. He had a kind of arrowhead in his back. But he had these really interesting tattoo marks all over his body. It's about 60-odd tally marks, crosses and dots and dashes. Actually tattooed, technically tattooed, probably in the same way that Grace is tattooing now.
Is that because you're a really primitive tattooist?
Yeah, essentially, because I don't use the machines or anything like that. I literally just use a needle that's tied to a tiny little stick, and I just poke the ink into the skin.
Anyway, before we get to that, here's Melissa, my producer, here for a chat. Hello again.
Tony, we're back. It's so fun. I love this. I've missed you.
Missed you too.
Thank you. But I didn't hear about Holly Berry and I'm so sorry.
Yes, my wonderful, beloved dog died over the summer. And I'm still in mourning, but maybe that's a subject for another podcast at some time. The way we mourn our animals now, we just get smacked in the face by it, don't we? Anyway, that's not for today.
I just wanted to say big love to you because we talked about her on the podcast, didn't we, when we did dogs.
Yeah.
So today we're talking about tattoos. Tony, why did you want to do tattoos? I got that message, I want tattoos, and I thought, okay, is there a history? But there is. There's an amazing history, isn't there?
Yes. It happened because I'm writing a novel about the medieval period, and I identified somebody by their tattoo. And someone I know and respect infinitely had a look at that bit of the book, and they said, I'm sorry, this is wrong. Tattoos didn't really start until the 18th century when Captain Cook went over to Polynesia. And I remember thinking, well, then that can't really have been when they started if the Polynesians were already tattooed. But anyway, I didn't think it was appropriate for there to be someone in the Middle Ages who was tattooed. I then found that in the Bronze Age, people were being tattooed, and not just kind of wiggly little snaky-like things, but very elaborate tattoos too. Once I knew that, well, you know what I'm like, someone so passionate about archaeology and about history, then there must be echoes from the Bronze Age right through to today, a real good podcast that we can start the series off with.
Brilliant, which we are doing. Before we get there, though, Tony, have you got any tattoos?
I don't discuss that. No, I haven't.
Go on, tell us.
I've thought about it a lot. Both I and my wife have at times thought about it. But in a way, thinking about it for a long time is enough. We've imagined them on us, and then we go off and get involved in something else. So no, neither of us have.
So what would it be if you were going to have one?
I think if I did, I would want something very, very elaborate, but very, very small. Like The Last Supper, but about 3 inches long.
Yeah. In a very private place.
Oh, for God's sake. 8 inches long.
Right, Tony. Well, I think we should get on to tattoos, don't you?
Tattoos, 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 tattoos. We're talking about tattoos today, and I have with me Matt Lodder, who is a tattoo historian, and Grace Neutral, who's a journalist and a tattoo artist. First question, pretty obvious one. Why do you love tattoos so much?
Would you like to go first?
I think you should go first, Grace.
Okay. For me, well, I think the love for, or the curiosity for tattoos and kind of like the way people change their bodies started when I was a kid. Because my mum, she had lots of different books in her art room with all these different pictures of tribes and different cultures around the world and how they like adorn their bodies with scarification and tattoos. That's my earliest memory of thinking like, wow, this is really cool. And then just taking over in school, you know, with like seeing magazines and on the telly and things like that, seeing people in real life, and also being into the kind of alternative music that I was into.
Yeah.
Tattoos kind of overlapped that culture as well. So it was just like something that I kind of got this lust for almost at a very young age. And
you say young age, how old were you when you got your first tattoo?
I was actually 15 when I got my first tattoo.
So was my daughter.
Scandalous. And how did you feel about your daughter getting tattooed at 15?
Slightly ambivalent. I tell you why, because I didn't think it was a very good tattoo.
Yeah.
You know, you go through that as a parent, you go through all that emotional thing of, oh my God, I want to be liberal, but I also don't want her to have something that's going to scar her for life. And then at the end of the day, you think, is it that good, really?
Right.
And I think that probably that's why I haven't got tattoos.
Can't make your mind up.
It probably wasn't.
Well,
that
I can make my mind up, but I'm ultimately at the in the hands of the tattooist.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Yeah, it probably wasn't that good if she got tattooed at 15. I mean, the crossover between people that do good tattoos and people that tattoo 15-year-olds is slim.
A very good point, Matt. Yeah. Very, very.
How
true.
Old were you though, Matt?
I also got into tattooing really, really young, but I was so obsessed that I knew I didn't want a bad one, because I saw too many people who I was at school with get them done underage, who would sneakily lie to their parents and say that they were temporary and that they would disappear after a few months, which is basically impossible. So I didn't get tattooed till I was 21, because I was just buying books and magazines and consuming everything I could about tattoo culture from when I was about 12 years old. And, you know, I'd been fascinated by it even earlier than that. And so, yeah, I sort of avoided getting a bad one, you know.
Yeah.
You're so smart.
I
did the exact opposite of that. I just covered myself in really bad tattoos.
I mean, I got a lot of mediocre ones, and I'm sort of running out of space and wish I had some more real estate left. But I was very lucky that I didn't, you know, go to the guy at the end of the road.
And you're a historian as well. I mean, you don't just cover tattoos, do you?
No, well, tattooing is the reason I became a historian. When I was sort of going to university, my dad said, no one will pay you to read books for a living, go and get a real job, right? And it turns out people will pay you to read books for a living, sometimes even write them. And I found my way to being an art historian, doing a PhD in art history, because I wanted to make sense of tattooing. And when I went to libraries and academic journals, what I was reading about tattooing and what I'd seen in my kind of early encounters with the tattoo industry didn't really make sense with what I was reading in these published books. And
what do you mean by that?
I'd read, for example, that, you know, tattooing used to be just for sailors, right? Or criminals. And my great-grandma had a tattoo. And she was neither a sailor nor a criminal. She was tattooed in around about the turn of the 20th century. Her brother came home one day with a tattoo machine. that he'd acquired from somewhere or other, and said, can I tattoo you? And she said, will it come off? And he said, yes.
What a terrible thing to do.
Yeah. So she had her initials tattooed on her wrist, ED, Ethelwyn Darby. And, you know, that kind of part of the story of the history of tattooing, the more vernacular, the more everyday, was sort of invisible. I mean, I've since found out that tattoo machine that my great uncle had may have been bought from a toy shop, because for a while in Gammage's department store in Holborn, around the corner from where we are now, you could buy tattoo machines over the counter, initially as electrical novelties alongside little light up boutonnieres and things, and they were in the Christmas catalogue for a while, and then later on as professional equipment. But tattoo machines were quite easily available in you know, on the British high street for at least a few years.
You mentioned the stigma that was, which is, it's ironic, isn't it? Because originally I understand that tattoos were actually called stigmas, but it wasn't just sailors and soldiers. If women were tattooed, they were thought of as sex workers, weren't they?
You literally are both like, so my dad, both my parents weren't that thrilled about me getting tattooed so young, but my dad had a really hard time with it because my dad was in the Navy. He was a captain in the Navy, and that's exactly what he associated tattoos with, prostitutes and sailors. That's what he said to me. So it was a lot for him to kind of get his head round the idea of me being so heavily tattooed, let alone wanting to be a tattoo artist. But yeah, there's always been this kind of like old school stigma with tattooing, which I think has been carried up until probably quite recently.
Before we started, Matt, you were saying that it actually messed up Egyptian history, this kind of stigma.
Yeah.
Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, so there's lots of mummies from pre-dynastic and through dynastic Egypt which have been discovered with tattooing, and actually more are being discovered all the time. But many of the ones that were discovered in the first part of the 20th century that had tattoo marks on them were women, and so Egyptologists were saying, well, who has tattoos? What kind of woman has a tattoo? Sex worker. So therefore, these tattooed women that we're finding from dynastic Egypt must be sex working women. And therefore, they're concubines for the dead, or they were kind of part of the imperial retinue of the pharaoh, or to accompany him comfortably into the afterlife. And that, of course, there was no actual, and it's, you know, actual evidence of that at all.
Just a Western opinion sprinkled on there.
Yeah, it was a Western opinion and a kind of, you know, early 20th century European opinion of what kind of women have tattoos, and that actually messed up the account of the role of women in the Egyptian courts for about half a century.
But those Egyptian tattoos aren't the oldest that have been found, are they?
No, so the oldest tattoos that we have actually in skin are on a European guy, an early Bronze Age, Copper Age guy called Otzi.
This is the Frozen Man.
Yeah, literally the Frozen Man. He was discovered in the 90s, but he dates to about 5,000 years ago, 3,500 years BCE. And we don't know much about him or his culture. Actually, we know a lot about him as an individual, but we don't know anything about his culture, really. He's the only person from his culture we've found. He was murdered. He had a kind of arrowhead in his back. But he had these really interesting tattoo marks all over his body. He has about 60-odd tally marks, crosses and dots and dashes. Actually technically tattooed probably in the same way that Grace is tattooing now. So 5,500 years, the technology for tattooing hasn't changed very much.
Is that because you're a really primitive tattooist?
Yeah, essentially, I am, because I don't use the machines or anything like that. I literally just use a needle that's tied to a tiny little stick just to give me a bit of grip, and I just poke the ink into the skin. There are different kind of variations of techniques and tools that are used, but if you go into a lot of like indigenous tattooing and tattooing from different cultures, you'll find it all started with kind of like the hand poke method.
Hand poke, yeah.
Hand poke, hand tapping, there's lots of different words for it.
And you do this, why?
I started working in a tattoo shop when I was 18 as a body piercer. This like tiny little like naive 18-year-old who just had these like big dreams to just fulfill certain body modifications and tattoos for myself, but also like learn different crafts within it. And I started off with body piercing, and I wanted to be a tattoo artist because I've always been very creative. I've always drawn. I've always liked to just be making things, drawing things, and to be able to to translate that into tattooing was a very exciting prospect for me. But it was also a time of tattooing hadn't taken off like it has today. It was still kind of living by the old school realms of tattooing, or Western tattooing, you know, with the kind of like old school male dominated, lot of biker influence and things like that. So for me to want to become a tattoo artist, I wasn't taken very seriously because one, I was a woman, and two, I was a body piercer. So the answer I would get when I kind of expressed I wanted to learn was no, like, don't be stupid, get back in your place kind of thing. So I didn't have anyone to teach me about machines and how they work. So I knew about hygiene, I knew about cross-contamination and everything through that, through body piercing. So I just thought, I'm going to do this on my own. I'm going to go and get tattooed by a few people who do hand pokes, see if I can get some tips and tricks and learn some things and just take it from there. And that's what I did. And little did I know really that it was full circle because of all the inspiration I'd got from my mum and tribal culture as a kid, for it to kind of come around full circle, that this had probably inspired me and been deep rooted in me from before I had even known.
I've read, I think it might be Tacitus, but it's one of the ancient historians, that the Thracian women,
yes,
so that's before Jesus anyway,
yes,
isn't
basically
it? They got themselves tattooed as a kind of assertion, if you like, of their rights of as women, after having been conquered, after having been treated badly by their husbands and whatever.
Those stories are interesting to piece together because they sort of come through the stories of Herodotus and Pliny and various other Greek historians. So you sort of have the, you know, victor's take on those a little bit. They're interesting because the Greeks didn't have a mainstream tattoo culture, right? But they did tattoo slaves, and they saw a lot of tattooing on their borderlands, including amongst the Thracians. And so there was a sense that tattooing was this kind of primitive, barbarous, kind of atavistic practice. But interestingly, they thought the Thracian female tattooing was very beautiful. There's lots of depictions of tattooed Thracian women on amphora and pots, for example, and there's this really interesting continuity between their clothing, the way their dresses and things are depicted, and the tattoo designs they have on them. And some of the ancient Greek sources kind of suggest that it began as a kind of stigmatizing thing done actually maybe on even Thracian captives in Greece, that then was kind of appropriated. I don't know to what degree the archaeological evidence backs that up, but certainly the Greeks were kind of interestingly ambivalent about, and this is actually again a story that kind of persists all through history into the present day, and sort of goes back a bit to this sex worker stuff we were just talking about, that tattooed women in particular get to be dangerous and strange and primitive, you know, in inverted commas, but also be kind of alluring and sexy. And it's this interesting, you know, particular dichotomy that tattooed women have had to face.
But there is something quite exciting about that ambivalence, isn't it? That I'm sure you don't mind that it's a bit edgy, that if you show your arm when you're buying a drink or whatever, suddenly your tattoos will be revealed and people will enjoy the drama of it.
So people say this to me a lot, and I'm sure you get this as well because you're very heavily tattooed. Oh, do you do it to shock people? And I don't think that that's necessarily something I've done it for. But you're right, there are levels, because sometimes it's really kind of empowering to walk into a space and people clock that you might be tattooed. Yeah. And then suddenly, I don't know, some people kind of like revere you and look at you like, wow, look at this person and what they've done to their bodies. Other times people might, you know, take a step back and be like, whoa. And sometimes I don't mind that because I, you know, space is nice sometimes.
There's an amazing woman called Amy Crocker, who was a kind of socialite in late 19th century New York. She was the daughter of a judge, one of the richest women in America at the time. Her autobiography, by the way, is called And I Do It Again, which is the greatest title of an autobiography I've ever heard. But she basically, because she had so much money and could do whatever she wanted, she got really heavily tattooed and showed them off. So a lot of women were tattooed in the 19th century because, like today, particularly good tattooing was expensive, but most of the time it would be hidden under clothing. Amy Crocker basically didn't care, was really happy to show off her tattoos. She'd been to Japan with her first husband, maybe got tattooed there, certainly seen it. When she came back to New York, while she was still married to her first husband, she called the most famous Japanese tattoo artist in the world, who happened to be sort of working briefly in New York, to her home. And she had tattooed on her her initial and her boyfriend's initial. And her boyfriend was this English actor who was poor. So there's all these layers. She was still married. She was rich and she was marrying this actor guy. And she had his initials tattooed on her arm. And then had a whole sleeve done of like beetles and demons heads and stuff. Because she could get away with it. And that kind of, and she became known as the Queen of Bohemia. And this kind of shockingness was part of her, you know, part of her kind of social positioning. Lord Lonsdale as well, around the same time, a bit later on, he used to come to clubs in London, and he was heavily tattooed, not normally visible. Most English gentlemen weren't rolling their sleeves up, but he'd roll his sleeve up at dinner to reveal his Japanese tattoos. And again, playing with that kind of shock and awe and surprise about what's going on underneath clothing.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, this is Tony Robinson bringing you my Cunning Cast. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating or a review. And do take a look at our back catalogue. There's a growing selection of shows there to keep you company. Everything from Stonehenge to why pies were invented, why do our dogs love us so much, and the legend that is Miriam Margolyes. I'm sure you're going to find something you like, so why not take a lucky dip? Go on, it won't hurt you. Quite a few members of the royal family in the 19th and through into the 20th century got tattooed. How did that come about?
Every royal visitor to Japan from 1869, which was the Alfred Duke of Edinburgh, right the way through to Edward VIII. And Edward VIII actually wrote in the 1920s back to his mother, I think, and said, I'm not going to get tattooed. It's a bit, it's illegal now. It had been illegal the whole time that everyone else had done it, actually. But he sort of was the first. Interestingly, he wouldn't think he'd care.
In parenthesis, what was illegal?
Getting tattooed, and let's say more civilly, being a tattoo artist in Japan was illegal from the 1860s. The Americans showed up in 1853 and said, "If you don't trade with us, we're going to invade you." And the Japanese thought, "Well, we better show the Europeans that we're as European as they are. Otherwise, we're going to get colonized." One of the things they did was actually adopt European racism and racial hierarchies and pointed to their indigenous cultures, particularly the Ainu up in the north of Japan, who have very heavy kind of Pacific style tattooing, including on the face, and said, yeah, these are like the primitive people that you've been conquering. We're just like you. We're conquering them as well. So tattooing was a way of separating kind of mainstream Japanese culture from the indigenous cultures to make themselves appear more European. But also, when the Europeans showed up, there was this fairly recent, not quite 100 years old tradition of what we now think of as Japanese tattooing. Very big, grand, decorative stuff based on woodblock designs. And again, the Japanese thought this makes them look not very European. But of course, all the Europeans, they were like, this is cool. We want this stuff. And so actually very quickly, all of like loads of Japanese silverware and cloisonné and print and stuff just left the country. So if you went as a tourist to Japan, the most authentic Japanese art that you could get was tattooing. And tattooists were banned from tattooing Japanese people, but there was this loophole they could get away with tattooing Europeans. They advertised to European clients, and those European clients included, for example, George V and his brother Albert Victor, many members of the House of Lords. George V, of course, got a dragon, obviously, and Albert Victor had some storks on his arm. But on the way home, they stopped off at Jerusalem, and their father, Edward VII, had been there 20 years earlier in 1861 and gotten a pilgrimage tattoo. And they actually write in, George writes in his surviving letters that, you know, he got tattooed by the same man as Papa. No one knew about, actually, Edward VII's tattoo until the 1880s, but he was, he'd been tattooed for 20 years by that point. Carrying on a tradition that goes back into the 1500s.
Harry must have one somewhere.
Well, people ask me that, and I suspect he probably does. I haven't heard this.
You haven't heard that he hasn't?
I haven't heard that he hasn't.
Which proves that he has.
Well, exactly. Yeah, but it's, so, I mean, tattooing around this time in the 19th century, particularly in Europe, it was already starting to be linked in European thought with criminals and, you know, in degenerates, but also with degenerate aristocrats.
Yeah, because when you when you said Owen members of the House of Lords,
yeah,
it sounded like the way we refer to the gentry in the closet in the 19th and 20th century. Is there much of an overlap between tattooing and the gay scene?
You must have a lot of gay clients.
Yeah, so my studio is predominantly queer as far as people who work there, and our client base is predominantly queer as well, yeah. I would say, yeah. From working in such a male, like I said before, from working in such a male-dominated, in many male-dominated shops over the years, that's all I'd really known, and I wanted to create a space for women and queer people and anyone marginalised in the industry, basically, which is basically anyone who isn't a white man. So just like a safe space for them as artists to come and work, but also people who aren't down for going into studios and getting that icy cold reception, which a lot of people were used to, you know, back in the day. And it still exists now in some places, but I think it's less. But back in the day, you would expect to walk into a tattoo shop and feel the kind of like people looking down on you, like you weren't worthy to be there, like you almost had to prove yourself to even want to be tattooed there, you know. So many experiences I've had and so many experiences I've spoken to other people about where they've had experiences just feeling uncomfortable and they're not in a safe space, and that was for me the reason that I wanted to create my own studio, and it just naturally happened that way, you know.
The history of Western tattooing is actually much gayer than people realise. Of course, it's a very homosocial act, you know, lots of men touching each other with no clothes on, not very many clothes on. One of the most influential tattooers of the post-war period in America was a literature professor at DePaul University in the term time and a tattooer in the summer. And he became a tattooer because as he got older, his name was Phil Sparrow, was the name he tattooed under. As he got older, he could no longer pick up the hot sailor boys that he fancied in bars because he was getting older. So he's like, how can I meet hot sailor boys? I'll become a tattoo artist.
Perfect.
And he, because he was an academic and a scholar, he was a correspondent of Gertrude Stein's in Paris and all kinds of things. He ended up introducing a lot of younger tattoo artists to things like Japanese tattooing and tattoo history, because he had this kind of academic take on the matter. In London, there was a gay tattooer called Mr. Sebastian who worked on Mount Pleasant, and he was basically sort of the tattooer to the gay scene, and all the rest of the tattooers, if anyone came in wanting something literally under below the belt, below the belt and above the knee, they'd send them to him. But it turned out, and it's turning out increasingly as stories are coming to light, largely after people pass away, sadly, that network of gay men actually was underpinning, really, the Western tattoo scene in Europe, America and Britain from the 50s and 60s, because they were the ones who were communicating, they were seeking each other out, they were matchmaking people, and many of them were so tattooed under their admittedly voluminous 1970s underpants, but completely, you wouldn't know they were tattooed if you saw them in their Y-fronts, but under their Y-fronts they were completely, and I mean completely, covered in tattooing. And I think and I certainly assumed that it was a kind of known about but tolerated part of the community. But actually, it turns out loads of those guys that Grace is talking about, I've got photos of some of them in their underpants in this guy's studio.
It's funny because I was going to say ironically, but I guess it's not really contradictory. When I was a kid, I thought of tattoos as a really butch thing, because my granddad was in the Merchant Navy. I think he was the only person I knew who had a tattoo. And when he rolled his sleeves up, again, it's more than a metaphor, isn't it?
Exactly.
There was the name of his ship and a picture of his ship. Only it was all faded now because he was so old. So it was like it was out of another time.
They're my favourite. I love those tattoos. If your tattoo's 35 years plus, like, I'm going to be obsessed with it.
One of my work colleagues just sent me a photo of her dad's tattoos that were done in Hong Kong in the Merchant Navy. And I just went through my archives and I found the original flash design from the tattooer that her dad would have got.
Do you remember who did it?
It was Pinky Ann, I think. Yeah. Almost certainly.
So my uncle David was in the Navy as well, and he has this, like, incredible back piece done by Pinky.
No way.
Yeah, he's got actually all his tattoos are done by him because same thing, Merchant Navy was in Hong Kong.
Who is this Pinky?
Yeah, Pinky Yan, incredible. He was Chinese actually, but he worked in Hong Kong for a long time. He also worked during the Korean War in Korea. He basically was like the main tattooer in Hong Kong in the post-war period and then moved to the United States in the 1970s and became a correspondent and a rival to and teacher of really kind of famous tattooers like Sailor Jerry, whose rum brand you may have seen.
There really was a Sailor Jerry?
Yes.
Yeah, he was a guy. He was a tattooer. He's a legit guy.
Yeah, he was a
guy. I thought he was just a product name.
No, lots of people do. Like Ed Hardy as well. Also, he's become a product name.
Yeah.
Sailor Jerry basically started tattooing in Hawaii in the early 1930s, died in the early 70s. He had real rivalries with some of his younger tattooers that he didn't like. He thought they were sort of young upstarts. So if you go to get tattooed in his shop, he'd give you a card and he'd say, go and see my friend Lyle Tuttle, who's a young tattooer in California. He said, if you're ever in California, go in and Lyle will give you a free tattoo from me. And of course, Jerry hated Lyle and would just send people there to wind him up.
You're listening to Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson, talking tattoos with my special guests this week, the Painted People, Matt Lodder and Grace Neutral. I've seen photos of a lot of these really ancient mummified bodies.
Yeah.
With these patterns on them, really sophisticated patterns, not just the dots and dashes that, what's his name, Otzi or whatever his name is, had. Really beautiful work. How do we know that that was something that was tattooed on people when they were alive rather than after the
death? So there are, they may yet turn out to be slightly older than him, but they're basically about the same age. Some mummies in the British Museum from pre-dynastic Egypt, naturally preserved and mummified in the deserts. And they are tattooed with not the kind of dot dash things that Otzi has, but for example, there's a guy, he's called the Gabeline Man, and he has a big raging bull on his arm. And on his other arm, he has a Barbary sheep. The way tattoos work, basically, is they are a product of your body healing after a wound. That's your immune system kicking in that keeps the tattoo in the skin. So if there is if there's ink in the skin and it's healed up, we can pretty much be sure it's a tattoo and not body paint.
And apart from the tattoos themselves, what evidence do we have of tattooing in ancient times? How do we know it was happening if we haven't got the bodies?
It's really so there's an amazing kind of constantly updated list run by some archaeologists of every tattooed mummy that we've yet found. A friend of mine, Aaron Dieter Wolf, who's one of the maintainers of that, was out in Berlin recently and he took a kind of UV camera with him and was just lighting up these Peruvian mummies in their stores like a Christmas tree, because some tattoos are not visible to the naked eye. Absolutely incredible, including actually the ones in the British Museum were only discovered in 2014 after having been in the British Museum since the 1890s.
That would be so cool in an Indiana Jones film.
Yeah, literally, you
just shining light bodies up and discovering the tattoos.
So there are some, and they're coming up, but then you have to look at other things. So the lines of evidence that come together are tools. So we're talking about tattoo needles or needles that may have been used for tattooing.
Ah, immediately. So my warning lights are starting flashing. How do we know, other than theorising, that a needle would be used for tattooing rather than cleaning your fingernails?
Yeah, well, in a European context, we don't really is the answer to that question. In places where tattoo needles have a particular form, so where they're hafted, so they're attached to a handle, and in places like in Polynesia, for example, in many Polynesian cultures, including in New Zealand, the Maori, they have toothed kind of combs almost on the ends of long-handled hafts that are then tapped.
Essentially, it looks like a mini rake.
Yeah, like a sort of small rake.
And they come in different sizes, and they usually make them out of boar tusk, albatross bone, and they have been known to use turtle shell, but they don't use turtle shell. The people that I've spoken to, they tend to not use that now, just for like conservation purposes.
Yeah. So those things you can pull out of the ground and kind of and date fairly reliably. In Native North America, Aaron works on cultures that tattooed with cactus spines, but also with turkey bones, sharpened turkey bones. You know, here's a little tip for listeners after their Christmas dinner, maybe. What he was able to do is recreate some needles from modern turkey bones, tattoo himself with them, and then compare them under a microscope to needles that are found in archaeological collections. Mm. And you can tell by wear patterns and ink deposits, ones that were used for tattooing and ones that were used for leather working or making of nets or whatever. In Europe, where the tattoo needles were more likely to have been metal, we really can't tell. And we have to kind of look contextually. The other things that people find are what are called compacts. So bowls with pigment in them. Ooh. Or razor blades for shaving hair. But there's lots of debate, particularly in places like Britain, where there's not really any archaeological bodies of that have had tattoos in them that have been preserved, about whether or not they're tattooing needles at all. It's very, very difficult. What we can conclude archaeologically is that tattooing is quite easy. You just need to create a wound and get some pigment in it. And by pigment, we traditionally, in most places in the world, mean carbon black, so smoke mm-hmm. or ash. Actually, exactly the same things that are in the basis of the professional pigments that Grace will be using today. But how you get that in, you can either slice open, or you can poke it through, or you can poke it in, or you can tap it in. Different cultures come up with different ways of doing it. But we can be pretty certain, I think, that tattooing has been pretty much everywhere always.
Grace, why are so many tattoos black? Why don't we see more multicoloured tattooing?
Originally, if we're talking Western tattooing or tattooing anywhere, like say for example, like people in the middle of nowhere in the mountains or people in prison and they're trying to create their own ink, they're probably going to use something, whatever it is that they can find, burn it, collect the soot, scrape that soot, mix it with some kind of liquid. I know in prison that they often use like baby oil, things like that, to create their own inks. Obviously, that's like the easiest colour to make if you're going to make like handmade ink from many different places, regardless of where you are. Also, I think it's just like the industry didn't have the money and the popularity that it does today. So there wasn't like the research and companies weren't making ink because tattooing wasn't as popular as it was 15 years ago than it is today. So just like supply and demand, and anything that gets more popular, and as the industry took off, especially in the last 10 years, everything's got better. Pigments have got better, needles have got better, machines, everything that you use in a tattoo setup has got so much better over the last 10 years just because everybody wants to get tattooed.
I mean, Sailor Jerry claimed to have invented purple tattoo ink. When a tattooer found a formulation that would heal in the skin without your body rejecting it and look good and not fade with constant exposure to UV light, if you're wearing it on your skin in a visible way, tattooers would keep that secret. And in fact, I mean they say it was secret, and then we find letters in their archives going, don't tell anyone, but here's the recipe, right? Tattooing really up until the 19th century was black and sometimes red. Mm-hmm. So even if you weren't using carbon pigments, you'd use organic plant-based pigments that ended up being kind of black. Occasionally we find red tattooing, which is from cinnabar, which is very bad news for your skin.
Yeah, it's the same mercury. Compound as rust.
It's mercury, yeah. Or you'd also, rust, iron ores as well got used. But the Victorians, as tattooing became commercialised in the 19th century, exactly what you're saying about the commercial demand, it was commercial tattooing, which happens for the first time in Britain in the 1880s. Those guys are trying to figure out how they can get one up on their competitors. And actually, they're doing that by going to the paint shop, one of which is still here in London, called Cornelison, buying powdered pigments that artists would use, mixing them up into tattoo pigments, tattooing themselves with them and seeing if they worked and healed. And Sutherland MacDonald, who was the first kind of pro tattooer in London, claimed to have coined the word tattooist as a contraction of tattoo and art, tattooer and artist, because tattooer made him sound too much like a plumber. He was like, I'm an artist, goddammit. But he talks to a journalist once about, trying to find a yellow, which largely at that time probably would have been cadmium, so yellow, lead-based pigments. And everyone he tried ended up like bringing him out in pustules and he had to cut chunks out of his arm. But once a tattooer found a recipe for an ink that worked, this goes right up into the 1970s and 80s, would keep that recipe for themselves or for their friends. And there was a real kind of industry and rivalry in chatting, what's he using for his red, what's he using for his pink, what's he using for his purple.
I think that just echoes through tattooing in general, tattooing, it's a lot different now with the internet. And like I said, because once something becomes, once you create a monster and it becomes its own beast, you can't control it anymore. So you can't control the information and or not stop the information getting out there, you know? So the people who wanted to keep tattooing gatekept, for, like they had been doing for so many years, couldn't do that anymore, you know? And now it's great. There is so much more access to information, and just there's a bigger conversation going on about tattooing and the structure of a shop and how it should be and how you should feel as a customer going there and all these things, you know, because it all impacts the way that a shop ultimately feels at the end of the day. And yeah, those, that kind of like old school gate kept secret boys club, it's kind of died out.
Between about the 1890s and about the beginning of World War II, all of the tattooers in London were making money by selling tattoo machines and house tattoo guides and design sheets by mail order or in their shop. So this kind of world you're talking about was an artifact of actually the time when, after the Second World War, tattooing wasn't so popular anymore. Mm-hmm. And so there were fewer customers, and so people wanted to keep their customer base. And so then this idea of, like, I'm not sharing my information with you really, really kicked in.
There was a big disjuncture after the war, wasn't there? Which was that soldiers were coming home from the concentration camps. People were seeing tattooing in a completely different light to how they'd seen it before, weren't they?
Yeah, that's right. So most of the very early, in fact, probably all the early stories that were coming out as the horrors of Auschwitz and the concentration camps were coming out mentioned the forcible tattooing of prisoners with concentration camp numbers. So tattooing becomes a really big part of the revelation of the horrors of the Holocaust. It's also a big part of the trial of Ilse Koch, who was accused, although it turned she was acquitted of that particular bit of producing lampshades with the skins of tattooed victims. That did happen at Buchenwald, but basically after she was no longer there.
Was she a Nazi soldier?
She gets called the Bitch of Buchenwald. She's like kind of camp commandant, I think.
Like the madam of the
camp. Was a big kind of overseer Nazi. She had a very, very public, you know, again, women being dangerous was a big kind of media circus. And the tattooing of inmates and prisoners and the Nazi fascination with tattoos was a big part of that story. Of course, like after the war, there's loads of tattooed people that have been tattooed in the Navy or the Army, or their wives and girlfriends who'd been at home who'd been tattooed, who might not have otherwise got tattooed, you know, in other circumstances. So lots of people got tattooed in the war who didn't like their tattoos afterwards. You know, they sort of come to regret them. That also then creates a generation of young people, of which you're probably one, Tony, who have parents who are tattooed, or a generation older than that tattooed. So tattooing's not cool anymore. It's what your dad does or your granddad does. It's not very hip. And, you know, and visual culture's just changing at the time as well. Everything's becoming sleek and monochrome in the 1960s. And the last thing, of course, that happens, and this again ties us back to what we were saying about sex work, is that the tattoos that are visible are people who are rolling their sleeves up at work, or who are wearing too revealing clothing, if you like, who are showing off their tattoos in daily life. If your king has a tattoo or your bank manager has a tattoo, you wouldn't know, because it would be under their clothing and they'd show it off in private, if at all. And so all of that leads to this idea in the 50s and 60s, particularly, that tattooing is sort of, you know, is not to be done. It's sort of stigmatized more than it ever had been. And it leads to this, exactly these ideas of, as their numbers of tattooers shrink. In 1955, there was only 8 tattooers left in the country. They're really become very jealous of each other and of, you know, their fight for customers. And actually that then leads to a really interesting core group of people around the world who then fight for it as an industry and its respectability. But I think a lot of what certainly I thought about tattooing when I started my career, and what persists in the public imagination, is really, if not exactly a product of the post-war period, it's certainly kind of ossified or solidified in the 1950s and 60s.
There is there's an elephant in the room, or indeed it may actually be an elephant, which is that you have both got a lot of tattoos.
Yeah.
And I imagine that people listening in will have totally forgotten, because you've got like voices like ordinary people.
Right.
So, Grace, tell me a little bit about the tattoos that you've actually got, the ones you're proud of, the ones that you're fondest of.
Well, I guess because I've been getting tattooed from such a young age. I'm 34 now, and I started getting tattooed when I was 15. And also, I'm a very all or nothing person, so I really went for the like gold star of get as many as you can as quickly as you can. So I don't know. I don't really have like favorites, I'd say. All of my tattoos represent like a part of my growth, a part of my creative journey, and just a part of my growth as a human being. And again, it's just like they're just pretty things that I've liked to adorn myself with over time. It will kind of just become part of me, and it's like you almost forget that it's there, you know?
Neither of you have very many tattoos on your faces. There's just a kind of Grace.
Grace has got a few.
Yeah, but it's like you have to pull, as though he's not telling the truth. But in order to show me, you actually had to pull your hair back. It's like
I've got the top of my head tattooed as well. But it's under my hair.
So when you've got the shorter hair, and you can see your head tattoos. I've got a fringe, so I've got a lot of tattoos on my forehead and down the side of my face and ears. So kind of like the central part of our faces aren't tattooed.
Yeah. Is that something deliberate that you haven't?
So there is something about the face that is quite transgressive. And although tattooing has a long, long history in Europe prior to the Pacific Encounter moment of the late 1700s, the thing that was really surprising to people like Captain Cook and Sidney Parkinson, who was the artist aboard the Endeavour, was the Maori facial tattooing. It was the extent of the tattooing on the face that was more surprising than the technology of the tattooing itself.
Sorry, let me just stop you there. Just because I'd like you to amplify something. You referred to the Pacific Encounter moment.
Yes, yes.
So what's going on there?
So in the 1760s, 1767, 1768... Captain Cook and French captains like Louis-Anton Bougainville start basically colonising, going abroad, going ashore in places like Tahiti, Fiji, Samoa, New Zealand. One of the kind of stories that people tell about tattoo history, there was no tattooing in Europe before Captain Cook discovered tattooing in the Pacific. And we do get the word tattoo from Tahitian. So in Tahitian, the word for tattooing and for writing in general is tatu. It's onomatopoeic. So as Grace said, tattooing there is done with basically a mallet and a long hafted needle that you tap. So you get tattoo, 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 tattoo. The word existed in English, meaning a drumbeat. We still have that, a military tattoo. So those things converge. Before that, though, in England, it was called things like pricking or marking or staining, pouncing occasionally. But what happens is, over the course of the following couple of decades, really, tattooing, because of the colonial narrative of that period, is really one way that Europeans use to differentiate themselves from these peoples that they're colonizing. A few hundred years earlier, when Europeans had encountered tattooed people in the Americas, the story was much more, these people are just like us. You know, our ancestors were tattooed. It still has a racialized and European hegemonic idea, the idea that, you know, somehow these cultures are behind us in some kind of cultural trajectory. But because Europeans had heard these stories about from people like Herodotus, that and Caesar and Pliny and others, that the ancient Britons and ancient Europeans had been tattooed, they were like, oh, look, this is like a kind of European tribe in Aspic kind of thing. But the colonial language and the rhetoric and the logic, if you like, of colonialism had changed so much by the 18th century that tattooing was a way to almost say these people are very different from us. They're savage, they're barbaric, they're other.
That's exactly what they did, especially with the Maori community in New Zealand. They branded them as savages, and then they also gave them false treaties. They signed over land that they didn't realise that they were signing over. Yeah. They were signing things that they didn't know. But I went to New Zealand, and I got to spend time with this guy called Moko, who is a guy my age. He's about 34, and he is trying to kind of reignite the cultural tattooing within his community and within his tribe.
There are big, amazing revival movements like that all over. It's really, really quite inspiring.
Exactly, yeah.
Christian missionaries, actually, in New Zealand, those practices did survive in a rump form. But in places like Inuit communities in the Arctic, tattooing was basically completely wiped out. And there are contemporary artists and anthropologists and artists/anthropologists who are working on that. But they're working on it from a much less firm base than the Pacific.
Grace, you've done quite a lot of work, haven't you, on comparative cultures.
Yeah, so I was lucky enough to get to travel around the world and just immerse myself in different tattoo culture to learn about it. And New Zealand was one of the places that we went, and it was probably one of my favourite trips out of the bunch. Like, not that you should have favourites, but it was definitely one of the most educational and moving experiences that I've had. The Maori community are an incredible community. They're so beautiful, welcoming. Their customs are beautiful. It's full of art, dance, music. Their tattoo culture and history is like super interesting. And just talking to different generations of the Maori community there and seeing what tattooing means to them, because they used the fact that the Maori people had tattoos as a way to separate and make them different and make people scared of them.
Even dehumanize.
Dehumanize them, exactly. And so, you know, the generation of Maori people who'd be like my dad's generation or my granddad's generation, they were, you know, taught through colonialism that they shouldn't have these tattoos, and they were kind of whitewashed, and that was kind of taken out of their cultural practice in a lot of places. But I met this guy called Tama Iti, who is a Maori activist in New Zealand. He's an extremely inspiring man, and he does a lot of work with the community and the government just to kind of get their land back and get their customs back. But he was one of the only people in his kind of generation to wear the full tamoko, which is the full face tattoo, and, you know, like be one of those people to force that resurgence and educate the children and his children. And in his community, in his area, the resurgence of tattooing is like beautiful, and it's a really sacred practice, and I was very blessed to be able to see it.
When I asked you 10 minutes or so ago about your own tattoos, you kind of veered away from describing your tattoos. Did you do that because it's something personal and secret, or did you just answer the question in a different way?
No, not at all. So yeah, I can describe my tattoo. So I've got quite a few layers. I got heavily tattooed when I was 15. From the age of 15 to 17, I just went full gung-ho with it. Got basically from my knees down on both legs fully tattooed, and I got a full sleeve on my right arm. And then obviously, you know, tastes change, you grow and you don't like things anymore, you like different things. And I envisioned different things for my body. Like, I got loads of colour. You're talking about colour tattoos, right? I got loads of colour tattoos when I was really young in my teenage years. Got full colour flowers, octopuses, all this crazy, vibrant stuff. And then I realised when I was 18, I was like, I just really like that chromatic aesthetic. I like black tattoos. I like heavy black ink. I like really bold lines. I like the way that a lot of heavy black work looks. So then that kind of spurred me onto my next chapter of tattooing my body, which was creating this symmetrical, heavy kind of almost armor-like structure of tattooing on my lower body. And yeah, it's been a really long but beautiful process, and I don't regret any tattoos I have, because I think everything that I've covered and layered over, it's been a journey and it's meant to be like that, you know?
Grace and I were in a book. How long ago is that book now? You're on the cover of it.
Yeah, I know.
Like probably more than 10 years ago? London Tattooing or something was the name of the book?
The London Book of Tattoos.
Yeah, and you're on the cover with your back piece, your swan back piece.
My dirty shoes.
And your dirty shoes and your blonde hair. So people can go and find a copy of that book, and you can see how both of our tattoos have kind of evolved.
I think we're both pretty irrecognisable as well from that book to now. I think we look very different.
How does Matt look different?
We're just very heavily tattooed now, aren't we?
Yeah, I didn't get anything visible until I had my PhD, and by then I'd started to get stuff done. But I've also had major facial surgery since then, so my face looks different. Not because of aesthetic reasons, because of functional ones. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one of the things I do as a tattoo historian is often I have to kind of try and identify if two people in photos many decades are part of the same person, and you can often go, oh no, that's the neck tattoo, or that's the chest piece or something, even if it's sort of in the later versions amongst other things. So they do become these, you know, to sort of use a technical art historical term, they become these indexes in time.
Can I ask you, was it like a conscious decision? Because obviously, like, I'm a tattoo artist, so I work in the industry. If I go and get my eyes tattooed or my forehead tattooed, it doesn't really affect my ability to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was getting your head and neck and hands, did you save that purposefully because of the fact that you are a historian?
Yeah, I do joke a bit that I'm less employable with an art history PhD, you know, outside of academia than I am with hand tattoos. But yeah, I didn't get anything visible until I had my PhD. And by that point, it was like, well, as I said, I'm unemployable anyway. Who's going to, you know, I've got an art history PhD. But like you, I do like that frisson of having on my passport or my bank card or something like Dr. Matt Lodder. And people going, oh, you're...
And they're looking at you like,
someone
wow,
said to me once, okay, you know, I'm the director of American Studies at the University of Essex. And someone said, you don't look like director of anything. I was like, is that good or bad? I don't know. But that said, you know, there, I have found articles from like 1982, for example, in a London magazine, which says, you know, everyone's doing it now, including university lecturers. So probably not as not as visibly as I am now, but there's always been... You know, there's always been sort of tattooed weirdos, and I mean that in a good way.
Yeah.
And sometimes the tattooed weirdos, they hid their tattooedness under their clothes. And when I got my job, my dad would help me move my books in to my office, and he said, "Oh, you probably wouldn't have got this job if you didn't have hand tattoos." And I was like, "No, you're probably right." Yeah. He was ruining the day. I'm probably a rare case that I wish I'd got visibly tattooed earlier on.
Grace, you talked about your eyes.
Yes, I've got my eyes tattooed. So you think of a tattoo, you think of the machine and the noise.
Don't do this at home,
noise.
Kids,
yeah,
by the way.
Do not do this at home, kids. Yeah, so we have tattooing, and then we have the body piercing, which is like a kind of subculture that overlaps that too. They collide these worlds. And then you have body modification, which is kind of like a more underground sector of... Because tattooing is body modification, you classify
yeah,
as
I think
right?
We like sort of, we'd call them like pseudo-surgical interventions done not by medical professionals, or not always done by medical professionals.
That is so a is that beautiful what, way to put it.
Almost like yes, it's my job.
He knows a lot. Yeah. Been to university. Well, so, what have you had done to your eyes then?
It's tattooed. So the whites of my eyes have had tattoo ink injected, not into them, because essentially there's like a clear layer that goes over the white bit of your eye, right? And the ink sits in between that layer, so on top of the white bit and underneath the clear bit. And it's a procedure that not many people do, but
it's very illegal in the UK.
It's very illegal in the UK. Body modification in general is very illegal in the UK. Mm. And, you know, they've made people an example of and sent them to jail for practicing body modification. And a lot of the time you'll find that body modification artists are kind of like these lone wolf, inverted commas, weirdos that kind of are always traveling around the world, never settled in one place. And yeah, when I was working as a body piercer, my boss introduced me to someone because I wanted to get my tongue split like a snake, you know, when they split the tongue. So she introduced me to someone who could do that for me. And then they introduced me to someone who could do all this other stuff. So I ended up being an assistant to them for many years. And in that time, I got my eyes tattooed, my tongue split, my navel removed, my ears pointed like a pixie, and some facial scarification as well.
Wow. The eyeball tattooing stuff is so interesting because it does have a sort of slight history to it. It was the technique to do it was developed by like ocular surgeons basically to like repigment people. There are some weird rare genetic conditions and things that can happen to your eyes that make them depigment, and so the way that eye tattooing is done, which is not really tattooing, actually injects the ink into the layer.
Yeah,
it was originally developed by cosmetic ophthalmologists or ocular surgeons in the 1940s, but it was basically a group of about four people in Canada in the early 2000s who sort of realised it was possible and found some people that could do it for them. And I think there's very, very few people in the world who've had it done. Some people who've had it done have gone blind, so it's very risky. You were one of the first people in the UK to get it done, weren't you?
Yeah, I think I was one of the first in the UK, but when I got it done, it was also, I was like 19, so 18, 19. So it was a long time ago, and it was just fresh off the back of the kind of that Canada meetup where they kind of, this group of people, they kind of experimented with how they were going to tackle this. One of the first ways they actually tried was hand poking to see if they could actually hand poke the way that I do it. So like manually take a tattoo needle and hand poke dots of ink underneath the sclera, which is the white bit over the eye. That that was obviously not successful. But yeah, then they realised that they could take an insulin needle and inject small bubbles of ink around the eye, and then they spread over a period of half an hour to an hour. But I say all this like it sounds so smooth and easy. Like, it was one of the... And I've had pretty much every part of my body tattooed, and I've, you know, cut things off and cut things in half. And it's not about pain, it's about risk. And eye tattooing was definitely the riskiest thing I've ever done. I would never recommend it to anyone. I get people ask me all the time, who did your eyes? Where can I get my eyes done? And I never tell them. I say, if you really want this done, you should think about it. And you should look at all the people online who have not had a lucky ride like me, because again, I was 18 and fearless and totally besotted with this world of body modification and tattooing. So I was so ready to sit myself down in the chair and be like, you know, do it, I'm ready, you know.
I have to say, it is a lovely and extraordinary and quite hypnotic effect.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
It's true. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say that because it sounds like I'm encouraging people to.
No, like, don't get me wrong, I love it. I don't regret doing it. I think I am very lucky though, and I need to emphasize that to people, because what happened was I was the assistant to someone who essentially invented the procedure.
Yeah.
So I had gone through a long period of time of seeing him do it, assist him do it, but also it was because of a video that went on YouTube of him doing an eyeball procedure that every Tom, Dick and Harry that does a bit of body modification thought that they could do it as well. Yeah. And that's when things really started to go wrong.
Yeah, and he wasn't the most like cautious and diligent of people a lot of the time as well, right?
No, if you check his criminal record, you'll see that's definitely not the case.
yeah, what I find so interesting about this,
I think
really,
that's the best throwaway comment we've had in the whole of any of our podcasts.
But yeah, I mean, I think human beings have been doing stuff to their bodies for thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of years, right? Tattooing seems to go back at least 45,000, if not 100,000 years. The kind of body modification stuff that we're talking about, other than tongue splitting, which is very new.
Yeah, there's a history to most of
that. Yeah, and the human body is very resilient. I mean, people sort of ask me questions and ask you questions all the time about pain and healing and risk. And of course, all those things are present. But basically, the human body is very resilient and is capable of some amazing things. And I think there is something about communicating through the body, through ornamentation, hairstyle, jewellery, clothing, that leads to the kind of experimentations that we're talking about.
How do you research the history of tattooing? I mean, looking at you two right now, I can only see, I imagine, about a 20th of your tattoos.
Yeah, this is the issue, and it's caused some problems, right? Because so much of tattooing is not visible, both because a lot of tattooing is happening under clothing and because the kind of people who were tattooed didn't have their portraits painted or their photographs taken without their clothes on. What that leaves actually is a really weird, I call it like an archival lens problem, that if you go looking for tattooing, the tattoos you find are tattoos on, guess what, sailors and criminals, right? Because sailors have their bodies recorded when they're enlisting, because it's helpful to, if they desert, to get them back. And criminals have their tattoos recorded when they're getting sent to jail, because then a magistrate or a jailer can connect up criminal histories in the days before fingerprinting and things. So academics who've tried to work on this problem in the past have gone looking for tattooing and found really only criminal and sailor tattooing. The more vernacular stories are much harder to discover. That's a fact that generations of academics, police officers, criminologists have failed to understand. And yeah, something that I've been trying to correct, you know. What kind of tattoo history do we find if we don't just focus on prison and criminal records, you know?
So much.
Yeah, exactly.
Grace, there's been tattooing on the cover of Vogue quite recently, which you wouldn't have expected a few years ago.
Yeah, so because I'm a hand poke artist, I've always had a fascination of different ways that hand poke is done and the different techniques, like some of the ways that we've talked about today, often from like indigenous culture. And there is a woman called Wang Ud. She is 106 years old and she tattoos in this rural village on top of a mountain in the Philippines. and she tattoos with a thorn from a, I'm not sure what kind of tree it is, but these trees, they grow these pretty harsh, gnarly looking big thorns, and they kind of strap them to a stick and tap again, hand poke with the tapping. And yeah, she's been tattooing for many, many years, and it's something that she's taught her daughters and her granddaughters to do. I actually chat to her granddaughter, who's also called Grace, because I followed her and her grandmother's work for years. But it's just interesting that now we have, you know, this 106-year-old indigenous tattoo artist from the Philippines, like, on the cover of Vogue magazine now, you know. If you told me that 10 years ago, I told you you'd be crazy. But
in the 1920s, 1929, there was a line of tattoo-designed bathing suits done by Elsa Schiaparelli, the fashion correspondent. So she was kind of, you know, this shocking knitwear designer. She did a sort of line of tattooed bathing suits. And both French and American Vogue, like, wrote about them. But they weren't kind of shocked that they were, like, tattoos. They were sort of horrified that they were a bit too busy and a bit too gauche. They were a bit, you know, they were like, no.
Yeah, I love
it's
that.
It's not very chic.
Right.
That was their critique. So, yeah, even Vogue have kind of moved on a bit.
Yeah, no, but I feel like Vogue are very, like, used to tattoos. It's just, like, the fact that, you know, it was amazing to me. And good for her. Like,
yeah.
I'm sure it's probably not even something that, does she even, like, I think, like, does Wang even know what Vogue is?
And she's, yeah, just this incredible, incredible woman.
She is. I would love to go there. I would love to get tattooed by her.
It's been absolutely fascinating. I've just got one more question, which I level at people at the end of every interview. I say, what's your cunning plan for your subject? I mean, what I mean by that, I suppose, is how you see the future.
What I do hope in my own work is that I don't have to keep sort of banging these same drums about tattooing being just for sailors anymore. I've been doing that already for more than 10 years. It hasn't quite sunk in yet, and I'm sure it will continue ever more.
Yeah, so tattooing is, so many things have affected tattooing, especially over the last 5 years. So if you look back 10 years, you have this explosion of popularity within tattooing. And it's not just, you know, like the underground kids, they're getting tattooed anymore, or the sailors or whatever. It's everyone's getting tattooed because it's so in your face now. It's everywhere in popular culture. You know, your favourite football player, your favourite boxer, your favourite musician.
I did notice a couple of years ago, there was an advert for the post office, and on the cover was a guy with his baby, and he had a full sleeve of a burning church tattooed on him. And I was like, times really have changed.
I love
so
that.
So what direction is it going in?
So I think, well, I just think in general, tattooing is much more accepted. Like you see it in everyday adverts, you see it in yoga adverts on TV with people with tattoos, and it's just very normalized now. So I think it's one of those things where it was this kind of underground, cool, edgy thing, and now it's become really popular. I think it will become mundane to the majority at some point, and I do think it will end up going somewhat, not the way it was, but somewhat underground again. Yeah. I'm not even going to lie. I hope for those days, because there are some really beautiful things about the evolution of tattooing, and there are so many positives. Like, I could bang on for it about the positives for hours, but there is some mysticism and magic that has kind of been washed away from tattooing being so popular. So to get that kind of mystery and magic back would be nice.
The first pro tattooer in London, in Southern McDonald, he said that tattooing was too popular in 1889. So tattooers have always been moaning that it's too trendy, right?
It's so
that
true.
Is so
you're
funny.
Not wrong.
I never expected that I would get two really sussed people who are covered in tattoos, and the resolution would be tattooing is too popular.
Yeah,
looking forward to the days when it's only us two.
yeah, when we're the only ones.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tony.
Thanks for listening. If you want to join in the conversation, you can find me on X at Tony Robinson, and you can follow all our podcast news on X and Instagram at CunningCastPod. And please don't forget to follow this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast is produced by the wonderful Melissa Fitzgerald and is a Zinc Media production.
Hold up. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.